Thank you very much. I have a handout here. The only reason he doesn't need the handout is because he knows it already. Okay, we are going to explore the theory of spiritual leadership by Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who is the late Lubavitcher Rebbe. That means he comes in the line of leadership of the Chabad movement, which began in the 18th century, and there were seven leaders, and he was the seventh, and he passed away in 1994. In fact, the anniversary of his passing is this coming Tuesday, the 3rd of Tammuz. So that's one of the reasons for picking this particular topic today. Now, the context, if you look at the first page of the first side of this handout, the context, if we're going to talk about spiritual leadership in Judaism, so if we're going to talk about spiritual leadership, we want to look at the context of this, and I thought of four models preceding Rabbi Schneerson's presentation of this concept. The biblical model, which of course, in fact, the Bible has many models, but we will just look at one, which is the figure of Moses. The rabbinic model, which comes out of the pages of the Talmud. A Kabbalistic model, and the Hasidic model, like the early Hasidic model of spiritual leadership. Now, of course, there are many aspects to leadership. And I call this spiritual leadership because, obviously, leaders guide in practical terms, in political terms. They defend, they protect. These are very important concepts. But I want to focus just on the way in which the leader, or whatever name he may have at that particular juncture of Jewish history. Just one second, Rabbi Brackman, how is the timing going to work? How long does this talk go on? Quarter to. Okay. The way in which, what my focus is this afternoon, the way in which the leader functions, drawing from the spirituality of the infinite, beyond God, the essence of God, and transmitting that in some way to the people. So the sort of the practical, the heroic, the self-sacrificing dimensions of leadership, which are very beautiful and endless, we're not going to explore. We're just going to focus on this one tiny postage stamp, which itself is infinite. How does the leader, the teacher, the Moses figure, draw or open the door to the infinite and enable you and me, the individual, to get intimations of infinity in one form or another. So we're going to start with the biblical model. We're going to start with Moses. Right? So in other words, I'm leaving out Moses defending his people when there was an Egyptian smiting an Israelite and Moses stepped in, or when he was defending not his people. He found the seven daughters of Jethro being attacked by the shepherds and he stepped in, he defended them, but we're not going to explore that. Okay, that's all very wonderful for all the leaders that we might talk about, but we're not, that's what we're not talking about, the white spaces. That's the white space round the talk. So the talk is focused on, hopefully, this idea of him as a conduit for the divine, as a conduit to those whom he is leading in some sense. Well, with Moses, we can start with the story of the burning bush, where Moses is being communicated to directly by the divine. So, fascinating story, where he sees the bush burning and it doesn't stop burning, and he wonders why. He doesn't seem to think that there's anything holy about it at this point. It's just strange, it's mysterious. And then suddenly God says, Shal na'alecha, take off your shoes, because this is holy ground. And from that we get a whole chain of concepts of not wearing shoes. The priests in the temple would not wear shoes. They walked barefoot in the temple, on the marble floors of the temple. Incidentally, Maimonides, who was a great doctor, tells us they got colds from this, and they had they wasn't so healthy walking around barefoot on the marble slabs, and there had to be a doctor resident in the temple, not to mention their eating of the sacrificial meat, which was roasted, but there we have the idea of the barefoot concept. Now, God there reveals to him, speaks to him, and says, I want you, putting it in very simple prosaic language, I want you to be my emissary and to go and take the Israelites, the Jewish people, out of Egypt, out of slavery in Egypt. So he's given a task from the divine. When he comes to the people, he is basically... he's there as it were, he's God's emissary now, trying to get them out of Egypt. He goes to see Pharaoh, and Pharaoh, you may remember, makes their work even worse than before. Instead of giving them straw for the bricks, now they have to make the same number of bricks without straw, and the people are very angry. This is the beginning of a long often tormented relationship between Moses and the Israelites. However, the high points of that relationship are the way in which he gives them commands. So, for example, he was working these miracles, which didn't directly involve the Israelites at all. He was working the miracles. The interaction is always with Pharaoh. It's things that he's doing. But the Israelites can see that he's doing this. And as a result, now he's very popular, even among the non-Jewish people in Egypt, the Egyptians. He's also popular. It's only Pharaoh who's holding on at the end to the... very grimly to these slaves. And finally, he gives instructions to the Israelites to make the Paschal Lamb, and that Paschal Lamb ceremony, where they slaughter a lamb, they take the blood and they sprinkle it with a hyssop on their doorposts, and they eat the lamb girded, ready to go. They roast it and they eat it ready to go. Now the lamb, the sages tell us that the lamb was an idol of the Egyptians. So by slaughtering the lamb and roasting it, which is a very prominent way of cooking something, Rabbeinu Bachai lived 1,000 years ago, a commentator, he makes this point. When you roast something, everywhere the smell wafts through the streets. So it was a very public way of slaughtering and roasting the idol of the Egyptians. So therefore there was a sense in which what they were doing by slaughtering the lamb was being dedicated to the God of the Israelites, the God of Israel, instead of the Egyptian deities, which the sages assume and suggest they worshipped. He's fine. They worshipped while they were living in Egypt to a great extent. And so here he is instructing them to break out of that and to show their dedication to the divine, and with that comes the actual exodus. You know, that sort of, that leads to the change in the final plague, and Pharaoh says, all right, I give in, go, please go, do all of you together, go, and they leave Egypt. At this point, what is the relationship of Moses with the people? He is telling them what to do. He learns what they should do from divine commands that are given to him, and he then transmits this to the people. However, a few chapters further on, we see an interesting vignette where he sits down to judge the people. This is in Exodus 18, verse 13. Moses sat down to judge the people. And the people stood round or waited on Moses from morning till evening. According to Nachmanides' interpretation, they are waiting there because there's a long queue waiting to get to speak to Moses. People have got problems. Two people have an argument together. Something like that. Maybe an individual has a problem. And they want to speak to Moses, and Moses is the only person who can solve their situation. And so they have to wait. So from morning to night, they are standing there waiting until finally it's their turn to talk to Moses and get an answer for their problem. Jethro, Yitro in Hebrew, who is Moses' father-in-law from Midian, a Midianite priest, the Bible says, the scripture says, the sages tell us, you see, the sages are intrigued. If he's a priest, why did the shepherds drive his daughters away from the well and wouldn't let them water draw the water? And they give an interesting answer. They say, yes, he was a priest. And in fact, he began exploring different religions. And he investigated this religion and that religion, the other religion. In the end, he rejected all of them. None of them satisfied him. And because of that, society rejected him. Because he'd like gone out of the box. He was not doing what everyone else was doing, which was, you know, it doesn't matter if you serve this idol or you serve that idol, but you got to serve something. And he wasn't serving any of them. So that's why, although he was a priest, in other words, a religious figure, a theologian, a great theologian, but nonetheless, he was rejected, and we see that what happened with his daughters. But now, so Jethro is now very happy with this new monotheistic concept that Moses is teaching, and he comes along, and he criticizes the way that Moses is behaving. He says it's not going to work. You have to get a whole hierarchy under you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tens. If you work it out, it comes to something like 78,600 intermediary leaders who will be set up for this community of 600,000 men and as many women, and then there's children and elderly people. So it's about 2 million people. So you have something like nearly 80,000 intermediary figures of some kind. The Spanish commentator Ibn Ezra says it's too many. But the later Spanish commentator Nachmanides says, what are you talking about, too many? It's fine. This way people won't have to wait all day in order to be seen. you have 80,000 coming up to 80,000 people under Moses, that's lovely. So you have a community of 2 million people, and there's this problem and that problem. You don't have to wait too long until you can find someone who is able to advise you. Ibn Ezra makes the point that at this stage in the career of the Jewish people, they haven't absorbed enough of Moses' wisdom to be able for 80,000 people to be found who have the sagacity to be able to function in this way. In fact, it says they should be men of presence, fearing God, men of truth, who hate profit. Who hate profit means they're not going to be swayed in any way by any kind of suggestion of bribe, or they're not going to kowtow to anyone. These are quite rare values. And so Ibn Ezra says, look, if this would have taken place 40 years later, you can understand, having lived with Moses for 40 years, they would be somehow inspired, transformed, they would be very different, and perhaps the whole people are on that level. But now, just starting off leaving Egypt, and they've only just shaken themselves out of idolatry, where are you going to find 80,000 people? Okay, Nachmanides doesn't address that point. You know, so Nachmanides is concerned about the practicality. Have enough people so that you can be dealt with. But, so then, what do we have? We have a kind of a substructure of leadership. Under Moses, and Moses is at the top, but still Moses is the inspiring figure. Moses is the one who mediates the theophany, the revelation of God at Mount Sinai. Now, what happens at Mount Sinai? The way the sages, the Zohar, Hasidic texts describe it, and indeed the biblical texts, the scripture, it was an astonishing mystical experience that everyone shared in together. The, adapting Aldous Huxley's phrase, the doors of perception were opened and they were able to see the divine life force which is there within all of existence. And the effect on the people was actually, it frightened them. They said, this is how it's described. You see, the event is described in Exodus 19 and 20. And it's also described in Deuteronomy 5. In Deuteronomy 5, we get a bit more detail about the people's reaction. The people said, why should we die? This great fire is going to consume us. If we hear the voice of God, we'll die. No ordinary human being can hear God speaking out of the fire like us. You, Moses, you go close to God. You hear everything that God tells you. Va'at tadaber eleinu. I'm going to comment on the Hebrew word in a minute. That's why I said in Hebrew. Va'at, and you speak to us. You tell us what God says to you. And we'll hear what you tell us and we'll do it. God heard what they said. God said, that's very good. If only their heart will always be like this, to fear me and to keep my commands. In other words, there's a suggestion, Moses is the one to hear the divine commands. We, the people, are going to stand back in safety, and he'll transmit this to me. Now, so the biblical text doesn't seem to have any problem with this situation. You know, God approves it. God says, yeah, that's great. They should always respect me in this way and keep my command. But Rashi, a rabbinic commentator, lived in France, the 11th century, actually off his own bat. I couldn't find a source for what he says. Most of what Rashi says, he's quoting from somewhere else, from a midrash, from the Talmud, but this doesn't seem to have an earlier source. He comments on the word va'at tadaber. Now, anyone knows Hebrew? What's wrong with that phrase? Feminine. It's in the feminine. Va'at is a feminine word. You in the feminine. When you speak to a woman, you say at. When you speak to a man, you say ata. Why did they speak to Moses in the feminine in this text? Rashi says, you weakened me, excuse the medieval paradigm, like a woman. We know, of course, women can be athletics in the Olympics. Great walker over here. London Marathon. But anyway, using this medieval paradigm, you weakened me like a woman. Moses says, wouldn't it have been better for you to learn directly from God and not from me? What's this pushing me towards the divine? What about you? Now, Rashi writes this. Does Rashi have any biblical support for this idea? I suggest yes, because we look at chapter Numbers, chapter 11, verses 11 to 17. Now here, this is much later. This is much later in the whole story. And we have the concept of setting up a structure, an intermediate structure. It's another kind of structure, similar to what Jethro suggested, but this is another one. This is the 70 elders, which later became the concept, or is the concept, of the Sanhedrin, which lasted, had a very long life through the history of the Jewish people. The people were very unhappy, and the people were saying they want to eat meat. They've got the manna from heaven, but they want to eat meat. And Moses starts complaining to God. Did I bear these people? I can't take it. Basically, he's saying, you know, it's too much for me. Now, a Hasidic analysis that we were studying on the drive up is that the way that Moses can't take it is, look, he can give you Torah teachings, he can give you Torah laws, but meat's going down too far. So in order to give you meat, he has to have a kind of a structure underneath, which is going to be the Sanhedrin. So God says, right, gather 70 men, and I'm going to take some of your spirit, and I'm going to put it on them. So the 70 men will have this spirit from Moses. They are going to be, it's described like a candle's lit from a candle. So Moses, from a greater flame, and they are all going to have some of this illumination themselves. And they will be a kind of intermediary of a substructure. And through them, there will be possibility that even meat can be supplied to the people in this way, somehow from Moses. Like going down, percolating down through the system. Now there's an interesting incident that happened. Because while this was happening, while these 70 men had been selected and began prophesying, they got the spirit of prophecy, but there were two extra men who also began prophesying. Rashi gives a simple explanation why there were two extra men. He said he had to pick out 70 men from 12 tribes. So that means 6 12s are 72. Choose 6 from each tribe, and then 2 will have to be told, I'm sorry, not you. So they drew lots, and that left out 2 of them. However, those 2 still began prophesying. So in other words, somehow the divine transaction included those 2, and they began prophesying. Joshua gets very upset. He says, Moses, get rid of them, stop them, they're prophesying. Like he sees it as a kind of rebellion. Rashi says, how are we going to get rid of them? Is Joshua suggesting executing them? Rashi says, give them communal responsibilities and their prophecy will soon die away. Anyone who's ever had to manage any kind of structure knows what Rashi means. So, now what was Moses' response? Moses says, this is Numbers chapter 11, verse 29. A key sentence. Moses says, are you jealous on my behalf? If only the whole of the people of God would be prophets, that God would put his spirit on them. So in other words, from Moses' point of view, he would like everyone to have spiritual power. So we can see then Moses is giving laws. In fact, the way in which the sages explore and understand these laws is that they themselves are spiritually empowering, because the word mitzvah in Hebrew, while it's generally translated as command from the verb tziva, which means he commanded, there's an Aramaic word tzavta, which means connection. And so what is normally translated command is actually a connection with the divine. So if Moses gives in the Torah a teaching, do this and don't do that, on the one hand this is a command, you know, like you've got to keep the rules. On the other hand, it's not a rule. It's a mode of connecting with the divine. And by doing this action and not doing that action, that's the way you intimately bond with God. Alright, so that's a way of understanding that facet of Moses' activity, the lawgiver. The lawgiver is also giving a mode of bonding with the divine. But in addition, Moses wanted this to have some kind of conscious dimension, if only the whole people were prophets. But he couldn't pull it off. But that's what he wanted. Okay, that is the biblical model. There's a lot more to talk about the biblical model, all the prophets and so on, and the way they behave, but we have not got time for them at the moment. We now go on to the rabbinic model. The rabbinic model we have through the generations. We have the transmission of the law. Moses received the law at Sinai. He transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets. You then have a long line of prophets bringing us to the time of the Second Temple. And the Second Temple time began a line of sages. The sages went through the time of the Second Temple. There was the destruction of the Second Temple. And then the sages continued. The temple was destroyed, but the Torah lived on. And Judaism lived on. And you have a chain of sages, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who wrote the Mishnah, and others. One of the events that we have in the Talmud, it should be Chagiga, I'm sorry there's a misprint, not Hahiga, but Chagiga, is the story about the four people who entered Pardes, which is the mystical dimension of Judaism, together with Rabbi Akiva and three others. Only Rabbi Akiva entered in peace and came out in peace. The experience was too intense. So in other words, the plea that Moses made, if only everyone could be prophets, it's not so easy, because in fact those three people, one died of ecstasy, one became a total recluse, and one left Jewish practice. So it didn't work. Rabbi Akiva was the great sage, Rabbi Akiva, who went in peace and came out in peace. But it seems he couldn't easily transmit that mode to other people. Then we have an interesting statement in the Talmud. The Talmud says, Rabbi Abdimi of Haifa. I like that because I was born in Haifa. Rabbi Abdimi of Haifa says, for the point of academic rigor, it's not necessarily so that what we call Haifa is what they call Haifa. Rabbi Abdimi of Haifa said, from the day that the temple was destroyed, prophecy was taken from the prophets and was given to the sages. What do you mean? Responds the Talmud. Do you mean the sage is not a prophet? No, he is. This is how you should put it. Even though prophecy was taken from the prophets, it wasn't taken away from the sages. So there's some kind of transformation taking place. sages are becoming prophets. Torah wisdom becomes a way that the person's mind is transformed and becomes a channel for godliness. And in fact, in that passage, it goes on to say, the sage, Chacham Adiv Min Navi, the sage is more powerful than the prophet. So you have this concept of a transformation where wisdom becomes a root to prophecy. Now Maimonides, in his Guide for the Perplexed, will accord 100%. Wisdom is indeed a root for prophecy. How you trigger off the final stage of the click, you know, where the prophecy begins, is a subtle issue. But the idea that through wisdom, in its most profound way of interpreting it, the most profound way of interpreting wisdom, with a contemplative dimension, but eventually one can break through to an exalted level of spirituality, which will either translate itself into leadership or into creativity, or into being able to tell the future, charismatic powers. So that means that study of Talmud, study of Torah, is itself a path for some kind of spiritual empowerment. Okay, now that's the rabbinic model as it comes down through the ages. We then have the Kabbalistic model, where there's the idea that there is a Moses, it pashtuta de Moshe b'chol darav v'darav. There's a spreading out of Moses through every generation, and you have the idea of a mystic leader. You see, the Zohar has the idea. The Zohar presents a small circle around the figure of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who was a disciple of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva, who tried to communicate spirituality, one of his disciples, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he becomes the figure in the Zohar, and he's seen traditionally as the author of the Zohar, and the author of the whole tradition of the Zohar. The Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai becomes the figure who is able to have a circle and is able to transmit to this circle a mystical dimension. And that is the Kabbalistic model moving on through the generations, the mystic circle, the leader of the mystic circle, like Rabbi Isaac Luria, and then the 26 disciples around Rabbi Luria who were being inspired and guided by him. Now, when we come to that mystic circle, Rabbi Isaac Luria could tell what the soul of his disciples were. Maybe he could tell the soul of everyone, but he would tell his disciples, your soul is a transmigration of so-and-so's soul in the Bible, and it's very good that your wife, who you're engaged to get married to, is a cognate soul, is a very appropriate soul, and it's very right that you should get married. And so there's a kind of a mystical insight and a mystical empowerment of people, including telling them the meaning of the mitzvot, of the commandments, the meaning of Torah passages, explaining Torah passages as being packed with dynamic spiritual meaning as well as their simple literal understanding. So that's the mystic circle, but it's a small group. And then we have the Hasidic model, number four, where you have the middle, the center of the group, is a Hasidic Rebbe, Hasidic guide and teacher. And he doesn't just have 26 disciples. He suddenly has a movement. And the movement is men, women, and children, communities. And those communities, I mean, the way Hasidism developed through Eastern Europe, and then as the result in the 20th century and after the Holocaust, began spreading over the whole world in many different countries. You can find Hasidic groups, and there are various key ways of telling them apart from the other. One way is the hat they're wearing. So you can tell whether it's a Lubavitcher or not a Lubavitcher, and then there's some people who have a tall Strimal which shows that they're a Gera Chassid, or a flat Strimal which shows that, so, or some of them wear white socks or other things. They're different, like hints, and different kind of texts that they study, and different spiritual leaders that they go to. And the relationship of a Rebbe and a Chassid in a Hasidic community, well, taking the one that I know best, which is the Lubavitch community, which, thank God, I try to be part of. Anyone in the lifetime of the late Lubavitch Rebbe, anyone could write a note to the Rebbe with a problem they have and getting an answer. There's even a case of a woman could not think what she wanted to cook for supper. And she wrote a note. She went to the Rebbe's secretary, and she gave a note. I'm not sure which period this was. It might have been an earlier Rebbe. And she asked what she should cook for supper, and the Rebbe gave an answer. And someone asked him, does it really matter what she cooked for supper? The Rebbe said, look, my job is to help her transform physical life into something spiritual. And so therefore, by her being empowered to cook supper, the Rebbe told me to cook supper in this way, on that way, that's a way in which, now when we read this back in the story of Moses, going along with this Hasidic interpretation, we've got a different dimension of Moses. Moses is able to give meat. He can even give supper, what to cook for supper. He can give a way of relating to the person that every kind of problem. There are something like 35 volumes of the Rebbe's letters, the late Lubavitch Rebbe's letters, written in mostly in Hebrew and Yiddish, but some in English. And you do get people asking, no, I haven't seen a letter, anyone asking about making supper. But you do, one person, I just read this letter a couple of nights ago. Someone says, I keep planning to do things, and then it ends up I don't do them. Can you help me? And there's a page long letter giving advice, saying probably you are trying to do things which initially are too difficult. And giving a very measured advice how to proceed. So that's the general concept of Rebbe and Chassid. Now let's turn over the page. We want to see Rabbi Menachem Schneerson's, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, concept of what a Hasidic leader is supposed to do, or what a leader is supposed to do. He's commenting on the verse, number one. This is in a discourse, which is actually the last discourse that he edited. He said it, he taught it in 1981. It's a Kabbalistic discourse. He said it in 1981, and 11 years later it was edited and given into him for final editing, for publication, and he gave it the final editing, and then it was printed. Now, he then had a stroke in 1992, and this was his last edited discourse that was produced, that he edited. It says there, commenting on the verse, and you, Moses, should command, tetzaveh, you should command the Israelites. Now, tetzaveh usually means command, but it can be interpreted to connect. He explains, the role of Moses is to connect the people with the divine. And it comes out in the course of the discourse, it's not only Moses, it's the spreading out of Moses through the generations. Every Jewish leader has the role to connect the people with the divine. Connect the people. And if you just say connect the people, it's not only connecting them with the divine, it's connecting them with each other as well. How does Moses do this? Because the function of Moses, the function of the leader, is to help people internalize faith. There is a concept of faith, but faith can very often be very hypocritical. And there's a story in the Talmud about a person, it's not a story, it's a depiction of a situation. A thief who is about, this is obviously before the Enlightenment, a thief who is about to break in to steal calls on God to help him. after the Enlightenment, the thief might have read Voltaire and he doesn't believe in this anymore. But at this point, the thief believes in God and he's stealing, unfortunately, which means he's going against God's commandment, but nonetheless he calls on God to help him, which I think sociologically is a genuine observation to this day. There are, just because a person is a thief doesn't mean that they don't believe in God. It's, the trouble is they're not doing what God tells them to do. So the role of a leader, and that can be on all levels, so the role of a leader is to shepherd faith. You see, Moses is called a faithful shepherd, which means shepherding faith. He feeds faith, he pastures faith to people. That's the role of Moses. Incidentally, not only to the Jews. The concept that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had was that a Jewish leader has to be a universal leader. So now, how does faith get transmitted? There are inner sources of faith. One is, there is a sense in which a person has a kind of a spiritual dimension beyond them, which is called their mazal, their spiritual mazal. We say mazal tov, which meaning good luck. But the word mazal is like a spiritual dimension of the person which can perceive the divine. And that is there, that we can have divine intimations. And that's one of the sources of faith. Not necessarily a very reliable one. People can have the most beautiful visionary experiences and go off and do the exact opposite. It's a fact of human nature. So that's one dimension. Then you have different levels of the soul, and there's a point where we reach the essence of the soul. The essence of the soul is ready to ride through any kind of concealment. It wants to be connected with the divine. Now, in the time of oppression, we're nearly finished. In the time of oppression, when there is some sort of limitation on people keeping Jewish law, for example, as it was in Soviet Russia during the time of Stalin and after that till Glasnost, it was tremendously difficult to be from the time of the revolution, it was extremely difficult for a Jew to be observant of Judaism in Russia. And yet these Chabad Hasidim and these Chabad Lubavitch Hasidim did manage to do this, often getting arrested and tortured and shot in the process, but nonetheless they tried with self-sacrifice to keep Judaism going in communist Russia. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, organized this throughout Russia until in 1927 he was arrested and condemned to death because of his work to keep Judaism going. But the point is, it's not his self-sacrifice only. It's everyone who was working with him and for him who were themselves risking their lives and sometimes losing them. There was international protests and he was released, but he was expelled from Russia. And he went from there and he spent 10 years in Poland. Then he came in 1940 to America. So arousing the essence of the soul enables the person to stand up against the most terrible oppression. And that is a dimension of faith which is triggered off by the right kind of leadership, the right kind of inspiration from leadership. But then there's something more subtle. What happens when there's no oppression? When everything is fine and dandy, physical terms, everyone is safe and happy. Even in spiritual terms, there are libraries with books, everything is open, is available, you can explore your spirituality in this way and that way, you can contemplate for 3 hours, 5 hours, no one's going to disturb you, it's all fine. So then comes a new issue. Are you going to be the only one who is in this enchanted island of holiness? What about the rest of the world? What about someone suffering in China or India or wherever it might be? What about another human being? If there is one remote corner of the world where there is someone who does not feel spiritually liberated, then those people who feel they are spiritually liberated are so only to a very limited level. Because if one person were truly liberated, then the whole world would be liberated with it. And so in order, so the real function of leadership, says the late Lubavitcher Rebbe in his last teaching, the real function of leadership is to make people yearn for that global, universalistic, holistic totality in which godliness is revealed to every human being on the planet, and everything in the world changes in a positive way, is transformed in a positive way. And that yearning is something which transforms the way the person looks at the world, and it also leads to an inner unity for that individual looking at number four, himself or herself as a total person, transforming also their ability to bond with others. How do we bond with others? Because we say, oh, that person, you know, he looks very negative, but inside there's a beautiful soul. I relate to his soul. What about his body? What about his character? What about his problems? Look at him as a very thorny, difficult person. Why is it thorny and difficult? That's Joe's expertise. Loving the person with an ultimate love, whatever kind of strange branch they've walked out onto, which causes everyone else to raise eyebrow. Thus, five, through arousing the essence of the soul in the second mode, the mode of yearning for total universalistic fulfillment, the goal of leadership is realized, tetzaveh, to connect, connecting the Jewish people with the divine and with each other, and through that ultimately transforming the entire world, so that the whole world is filled with knowledge of God and awareness of God, the empowerment from God as the waters cover the sea. Thank you.